Prophet Muhammad, Amir al-Mumineen, Sayyidah Zahra, Salamu alayha, and Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, according to lots of hadith, hadith Ghadir, I don't know, hadith Saqalain, and lots of hadith, they're Ahlul Bayt. If you want to go enter in Jannah, you have to have Shafa'at of Ahlul Bayt, and you have to have Ma'rifat of Ahlul Bayt. That Ma'rifat is going to knowledge of Ahlul Bayt, that understanding of Ahlul Bayt, that Ma'rifat of Ahlul Bayt is going to help us to be in paradise, inshallah. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Ammar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the skies over the Zionist-occupied territories were lit up by hundreds of Iranian drones and missiles late on Saturday night and early Sunday morning. Settlers ran for cover while natives looked up to the skies with hope, and people in the region celebrated the beginning of Iran's retaliatory strikes against the Israeli entity. Well, stay with us as we look at what it all means, Iran's retaliatory attack on the Zionist regime, and now what's likely to happen on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Bethlehem, New York, former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter. Out of London, historian and author Shivan Mahendraraja.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start it off in London, actually, with Shivan. And the Israeli regime being an invincible power has been a narrative that the Western hegemonic front, along with the regime, has propagated for decades. And, of course, the resistance front has been destroying the narrative for years now, from Hezbollah to Hamas and now Iran, with its retaliatory strikes inside of the occupied territories. Your thoughts about how this has affected the Zionist regime, actually losing this narrative and understanding that it's definitely not invincible.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. I'm actually honored to also be with Scott Ritter on the show. So I actually think that this is really an eye-opener for Israelis, and I mean just ordinary Israelis as much as it is for the government, because this narrative of invincibility has been built up for many years, but also the younger generation has not experienced war. They have not had to go into air raid shelters, nor have to hear air raid warnings like their parents and grandparents did up through the Yom Kippur War. So this raid of something like 185 drones, some 110 ballistic missiles, they came in from different parts. So all of Israel was lit up with air raid warnings, about 750 air raid warnings, I believe. I could be wrong. But anyway, a lot of people are going into shelters. They were panicking even before this. And now that sense of security is gone because this is actually a very successful raid. Now, there are people who are saying, oh, well, only about three or four missiles hit. Everything else was shot down. Actually, no, because what they did was to overwhelm and to confuse the air defense systems of Israel, plus all the people who were helping Israel, Jordan, U.S., France, Britain, and the U.S., of course. And the targets were hit, what they wanted to strike. Some of the other missiles and drones were shot down, but it was at a huge cost, not just financial cost, but in terms of the interceptors that were used. They cannot keep doing this if they want to escalate with Iran, and Iran keeps launching wave after wave after wave, day after day. At some point, Israel is going to run out of missiles because these things just can't be manufactured overnight, and there is a limited amount of stock, and the U.S. has to hold on to some of the stock that they have for their own purposes, as well as all the other things that they want to do in terms of, you know, a war with China or in case NATO needs them. So anyway, I think this is quite successful, and it was what I call a reconnaissance in force, by the way, in the sense is that they use a fair amount of force, but not overwhelming force. And I think the Iranian IRGC aerospace learned a lot about Israel's air defenses from what happened yesterday as to what can get through, what Israel can throw back up at them. So that if this escalates, there is a lot that they can use.
Okay, stay with me, Shivan. Sorry to interrupt. Let me get Scott in on this conversation. Well, Scott, I mean, your assessment of Iran being able to penetrate the Israeli airspace and several layers of its defense mechanisms.
Well, first of all, I want to echo everything that your guest Shivan just said. He's 100% correct. This was an extraordinarily successful attack by Iran on Israel. We need to understand, first of all, the objective of the attack. It was to prove a point that Iran could, in fact, strike Israel at a time and place of its choosing. Iran made a decision, I believe, in this attack to limit the scope and scale of the attack so as to not give Israel a reason to retaliate to the Iranian retaliation. The Iranians wanted to demonstrate a capability, put Israel and its allies, including the United States, on notice that Iran possesses a viable deterrence, and that Iran will strike those who strike Iran, and that the price that will be paid will be heavy, and therefore nations should think twice before attacking Iran. And I think that this objective was achieved. We see that by the United States pressuring Israel not to launch an attack, and Israel not pushing back very hard, because Israeli officers, you know, you talked about this narrative, this concept of Israeli invincibility. Israeli officers, and I've worked with them in the past, are very professional. They're very realistic, and they know what the truth is. They have, for the past 2 years, conducted war games where they exercise a scenario that has Israel being attacked simultaneously by Hezbollah, by Syria, by Iran. And a key aspect of their thinking going in, of the calculations they make, is the effectiveness of their air defense systems. And you have politicians in Israel who give high credence to Israeli air defense. And you have the military that's more balanced, more realistic. They know for certain now that their air defense will not stop an Iranian attack, that if Iran was to launch a full-scale attack, combined with Hezbollah, Syria, and others, that they would overwhelm Israeli air defense and inflict devastating, if not lethal, damage to the Israeli state. And so this is the impact. The Israelis now know for a fact that should they ever attack Iran, the consequences to Israel will be devastating. And this is the element of deterrence that Iran wanted to establish.
Okay. Well, speaking of that element of deterrence, Shivan, do you think in general that with Iran's attack on the Israeli regime, that there is now a different paradigm which has been established, and that the Israelis realize that they will have to answer, Tehran will make them answer, perhaps even inside the occupied territories, for any type of aggression that they may initiate against Iran?
Yes. What has happened before is that since Iran was practicing strategic patience, there were many commentators and probably some, you know, in intelligence services and the military as well, who probably, you know, in Europe, U.S., Israel, who thought Iran was scared, that they were afraid to actually hit Iran, to hit Israel, but they would only use quote-unquote proxies to do the work for them. What happened today shows that Iran is more than willing to strike into Israel. And the announcement that the age of era of strategic patience is over is, I think, a very big announcement, because now what they are saying out of Tehran is basically, you hit us anywhere on our soil or in Syria, we will strike you at home. No more of this quote-unquote proxy business. And that, I think, should be a very, very strong lesson. But I think there's also the other factor which I would like to add in here, which also gets into the deterrence, is that now some of this information is very preliminary as to how many were launched, how many were shot down, what happened. But there is one good estimate out there that says that only about 50% of Iran's ballistic missiles were actually shot down. And this should scare not just the Israelis, but the Americans as well, because the systems used by the Israelis for the most part are American. Now think about what's happened, what would happen if Israel does manage to create a regional war, which is what Netanyahu wants, which means the United States gets involved. Now, Israel has a very thick air defense blanket, but some of the American bases, in certainly in Syria and in Iraq, but also in some of these other countries like Qatar, don't have that kind of air defense capability. And if Iran can get through to Israel's air defense, Israel's air defenses, they will be able to overwhelm American air defenses in Syria, Iraq, Qatar, UAE, and Kuwait. And that should scare the Americans into thinking, you know, Israel, don't do anything stupid.
Okay. Well, Scott, as you said earlier, Iran initiated a calculated and limited response against military sites. Now, why do you think that Iran gave a controlled response? And also, I'd like to look at the example that Iran is showing by not attacking civilian areas, but only military targets. I mean, much opposite of what, unfortunately, we have been witnessing the last 6.5 months in the genocide in Gaza.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to point out that Iran did not initiate the sequence of events that led to this, to the need for this action. That Iran is responding to irresponsible and illegal behavior on the part of Israel. Behavior that isn't just limited to the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, but has extended to Israeli involvement in the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists on Iranian soil, etc. Your other guest, Mr. Shivan, talked about Iran's policy of strategic patience, but it's more than that. Let's look at what Iran's been doing diplomatically in the last year or so. One, normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia. That's a very big step that shows that Iran is not posturing itself for regional confrontation, but rather regional stability. Iran has joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran has joined BRICS, which means that the Iranian focus is not on military aggression, but economic co-prosperity, economic cooperation. Iran has been struggling under international sanctions for decades now, and they are finally seeing a pathway to where they can, look at, normal economic relations with a good percentage of the world. Iran's not going to throw this away in an irresponsible military behavior. Iran is not looking for a fight. But Iran also can't stand by and allow Israel to carry out an attack of this nature, because left unpunished, Israel would just be more emboldened to do bigger and bigger acts. So Iran had no choice but to carry out an act of this nature. But this action was designed not to be decisive. I think people need to understand that. This was a deliberate act of constraint on the part of Iran, because they are not looking for a war. They are looking for peace. They are looking for stability, but they had no choice but to reestablish a policy, a posture of deterrence. And they've done that. It was a very calculated action on the part of Iran, both in terms of how they did this. What nation broadcasts the fact that they're going to attack another nation 5 hours in advance? And yet that's what Iran did, by sending out in a very publicized manner its loud Shahid drones. They told Israel, here we come. You have 5 hours to move your critical material away from stuff. Look at what they targeted. They didn't saturate an airbase. They hit one or two runways. They hit some empty warehouses. They let Israel know that Iran can look at a point on a map and hit that point on the map. But they also let Israel know that Iran deliberately avoided the high-value targets, deliberately avoided the places where they could generate high numbers of casualties. Iran was not looking to punish Israel. Iran was simply looking to put Israel on notice that if Israel continues this behavior, Israel will be punished. But Iran is not looking for a fight. Iran is not looking for a war. Iran is looking for regional peace and prosperity that, is engendered by stability, political stability, not the instability of conflict.
Right. Well, what about that, Shivan? You heard what Scott said, that Iran is not looking for a fight. But when we look at the reactions, whether we're talking about, you're in London, Rishi Sunak, and what he said, for example, after the Iran's retaliatory attacks, and saying that, again, the UK stands with Israel and condemned the Iranian attacks. And, of course, we saw the same thing coming from other various Western countries. Your thoughts on that? Because this continual scenario that this Western hegemonic front has tried to show, as Iran basically being the bad guy, the terrorist, and of course then the Israelis being the defenders of democracy. I mean, do you think that we're transitioning, that more and more people understand that lie now?
I think so. I think, what has happened over the last 6 months has changed a lot of minds all across the world. Even people who were formerly very pro-Israel have turned against Israel, given what has happened. There are, for example, some very strong conservative voices, like I think Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson, who have actually been critical. And I think the narrative is changing. People like Rishi Sunak and that EU person, von der Leyen, or whatever they call her. I mean, people are just tired of them. I actually don't even read their tweets or their stuff, because it's the same thing that's recycled. And I think this is true for millions of people around the world, that they just see these Western leaders as hypocrites who talk about democracy, civil rights, civil liberties, human rights, but they don't actually exercise it. And I think these 6 months of Gaza has exposed that. So I don't know who listens to these people anymore, except those who are deeply devoted to one particular narrative and will not change their minds. I mean, you see lots of Jews. I was home in New York in October, and there were lots of Jews. I'm a New Yorker. I'm living here. But I saw lots of Jews out there protesting, what is going on in Gaza. And this is really one of the things that the media do not want to talk about, is that the Jewish view of Israel is not monolithic. And you can see that in the major Western cities and capitals as well. So I don't know who Rishi Sunak is trying to convince, except, what we call preaching to the choir, maybe.
Right. Well, looking at this, the Western hegemonic front, Scott, we saw that last night during Iran's retaliation attack that France, UK, US, Jordan were all involved in actually trying to shoot down Iranian drones. Your take on that? I mean, what does that say about the Israeli regime itself? Does it mean that it does not have the capacity to take on Iran at all or alone? And what does that do for their own self-confidence in being that they could not do this alone?
Well, first of all, we need to understand that Israel has war gamed out this scenario. And so they know the data. And they know what their saturation point is when it comes to their air defense ceasing to be effective against incoming targets. The other thing is the United States, France, Great Britain, they are part of this game of keeping Israel out of a broader war with Iran. And so it was in their interests to shoot down these targets. Iran wanted them to shoot down these targets. Iran sent overwhelming force that required the United States, Great Britain, France to put up their airplanes, to bring in their air defense, to come to the assistance of Israel, to mitigate the potential damage that could be done. And it was also a signal to all parties that, you know, Israel cannot stand alone. And therefore, it's in the interest of these parties to keep Israel out of a broader war, because in order to save Israel, they will have to be involved. But the same missiles that hit targets in Israel with precision accuracy can hit a British base in Cyprus. They can hit a French base. They can hit American installations in the Middle East. All of these nations now know that Iran has a capability that can hurt them in a time of conflict. And so this was a sort of this act of grand theater where Iran and the United States, they wrote a script, because the United States did not want, the United States knew that Iran had to strike. They understood the political reasoning behind it. They didn't want Iran to launch an overwhelming attack, and they let Iran know that. And Iran, not wanting a broader war, replied by sending enough force to send a message, but not too much, so that the United States could write a script that had its aircraft, its ships coming to the assistance of Israel, demonstrating friendship at the same time that Joe Biden picks up the phone, tells Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States will not participate in an attack against Israel. So we're friends under certain circumstances, but the friendship is not limitless. This is, again, part of the script that Iran was shaping. I think the Iranians deserve far more credit diplomatically as well, that this is not just a military victory. This is a diplomatic achievement of some note.
All right, and last question, Shivan. We only have like a minute of time, but there were videos being shown last night, Palestinians celebrating. Gazans are saying it was the first time that there was no buzzing of drones over their heads, and also Palestinians in the West Bank even trying to tear down the apartheid wall. Let's talk in general about what could it mean. I mean, Iran has penetrated Israeli airspace, but if the Muslim countries were truly independent and united, what could that mean for the Palestinians?
Well, I think there was a great deal of cheering going on from Muslim countries. I saw comments from Pakistanis. I actually tweeted something from the Taliban where they were actually praying for success.
Well, I'm mainly talking about the Muslim countries right on side of Palestinian territories.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, that's kind of difficult because, I mean, you know, their rulers are very much in terms on the side of the United States, and they will do what the United States wants them to do. So I'm not quite sure how much benefit there will be for the people, even though they will privately cheer, and I'm sure Jordanians and Lebanese and so, and Saudis and so on may have been cheering for Iran, but how that will benefit the Palestinian people is very difficult, because governments are not going to be supporting the Palestinian people.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Scott Ritter, former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer out of New York. Shivan Mahandaraja, historian and author out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight right here at Press TV. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the people right here in Tehran.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Let's listen to the 15th verse of chapter Naml.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Wa waritha Sulayman Daud wa qala ya ayyuhan الناس علمنا منطق الطير وأوتينا من كل شيء إن هذا لهو الفضل المبين
And Solomon inherited David. He said, O people, we have been taught the language of birds, and we have been given from all things. Indeed, this is evident bounty.
So, In the previous episode, we thoroughly discussed the meaning of ilm. وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا دَاوُودَ وَسُلَيْمَانَ عِلْمًا What is this kind of knowledge? We sufficiently, I presume, discussed in the previous episode regarding the different potentialities, possibilities, and interpretations of the commentaries regarding this word. We concluded, however, that this must be a kind of knowledge, a kind of extensive and vast knowledge that envelops every other kind of specific, narrow, and actually subject that all the prophets need. This must be an extensive kind of knowledge that is needed for the creation of very vast and powerful domination, for a very vast kind of government that this Actually, government, creation of government, was the fundamental difference between the government of these two prophets with that of the others. Anyway, what did these two say after being granted from the side of the Almighty Allah by this kind of power, actually knowledge, which is actually power? Anyway, they said, Alhamdulillahi alladhi faddalana ala kathirin min ibadihi almu'mineen. They said, thank you, Allah. They said, praise belongs to Allah, who has favored us above many of his believing servants. So it is really interesting, because after immediately stating the great merit of knowledge, it speaks of thanksgiving. Why? I presume it is spoken of to make it clear that there is a thanksgiving for every blessing. And the reality of thanksgiving is that every blessing should be used in the same way that it has been created for. And these two great prophets did their best from their knowledge in formation of a divine government. By the way, they introduced the criterion of their own superiority to others by having knowledge, not by having power and government, and they also applied thanksgiving for having knowledge, not for the merits, because of all values that belong to knowledge. And all powers originate from knowledge. As I said, they knew that this knowledge is pretty much extensive and actually envelops everything, so they thanked God for this. This is the point which is pretty much noteworthy.
على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
حفظ الكتاب بصدره فبدا وضيئا كالنجوم تألقا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, brothers and sisters, regarding this 15th verse of chapter Naml, we were saying that the Almighty Allah provided them with this kind of power, a kind of power which is called knowledge. Why? When we refer to different verses of the Holy Quran, we understand that this knowledge could not be limited to any specific and narrow field of knowledge. This could not be referring to just one simple kind of knowledge, which is, for example, a knowledge of talking to birds. This is not something very unique, something very generalizable, something very extensive to be accounted for in the path of creating one domination, in the path of creating one absolute government, which is the fundamental difference between that of these prophets and that of the others. So this knowledge is the extensive knowledge that envelops every other kind. So, and in response to that, they said, Alhamdulillahi alladhi faddalana ala kathirin min ibadihi al-mu'mineen. Praise belongs to Allah who has favored us above many of His servants. And it is interesting that Holy Quran talks about this important thing, after which it is rightly mentioned the power of thanksgiving they were granted with. And this is very and pretty much valuable. The point is also noteworthy, that they did thank for governing a over faithful people, since governing over a corrupted people who are disbelievers is not an honor. So they said, Alhamdulillahi alladhi faddalana ala kathirin min ibadihi almu'minin. They said, praise belongs to Allah who has favored us above many of his believing servants, being superior to disbelievers, being superior to people who are misled is not accounted as something valuable. So they just mention being over the good people, being over Muslims, being over true faithful people, and they count that as something which is, of course, of a value. Then arises a question here, and the fact is, why did they say in their thanksgiving that he had favored them above many of his believing servants? And they did not say over all believing people, though they were, of course, prophets who were above all people of their time. Using this kind of meaning may be for observing the principles of discipline and humility, that one, in any rank, must not think of oneself above all. So, or it is for the sake that they did not consider only a particular part of time, but they considered the whole times, and we know that there have been some other greater prophets than them during the history of man. Thank you for staying with us. We are done with the 15th verse of chapter Naml. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, keeping your spirituality healthy. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we are here on A to Z talking about how to keep our spirituality healthy. Now, of course, you know, we always think about keeping our body healthy, and that is something that is really important, because our body is, you know, of course, this vehicle or this means via which we go about our daily routine, and we go about doing our daily tasks. But along with mere physical healthiness and this healthy lifestyle, of course, you have this spiritual aspect of a human being. And this spiritual aspect is just as important, if not perhaps more important than that physical aspect. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, we don't take care of our health in the physical term, but what it does mean is that, you know, if for some reason, God forbid, we're not very healthy, you know, our, you know, fat, you know, body mass index is not exactly perfect, that isn't as bad as if our spiritual state of health is really bad and we are unhealthy when it comes to our spiritual life. And so just as we have a healthy lifestyle, we have a Islamic lifestyle. And that's, you know, what we talk about on A to Z when it comes to Islamic lifestyle. Now, when it comes to spirituality and having a healthy spirituality, of course, this does have an effect on a person's physical body as well. You know, when you feel good, when you feel happy, when you feel spiritually satisfied, this is the manner in which the physical health also improves, and of course, the spiritual health will also improve if we work at it. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how to keep ourselves spiritually healthy. We talked a little bit about how, you know, our body, yes, it does need us to take care of it. But when it comes to our spirit and our soul, which is that which is everlasting, that also requires a lot of attention and it requires work. And, you know, we need to work on our spiritual health. Now, when it comes to our spiritual health, of course, having a good communication and a good, healthy relationship with God, Almighty Allah, is something that is incredibly important. And that's something that we need to work at. This can be done, of course, in a various different ways, whether it is the five daily prayers, which help us to connect to Allah, you know, on a daily basis, five times a day, you know, because we're focusing on God when we are praying and we are doing our wajib obligatory prayers. And really, it's kind of like five times a day we are encouraged, you know, we are requested to come to the court and the presence of the Almighty God, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you know, and spend some time speaking with Him. Now, this speaking with Allah, if we understand what's going on, is what creates a relationship with God. That relationship with Allah is what keeps us spiritually healthy. Of course, the recitation of the Holy Quran with its meaning, this is also very important when it comes to having a healthy soul and a healthy spiritual life or a Islamic lifestyle. So just, you know, very few and short points on how to have a healthy spiritual life in our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
Pro-Palestinians in France gathered the day after what was reported to be the first peaceful night in Gaza in 6 months. The reason? The night before, Iran launched a historic missile retaliation against Israel, which prevented Tel Aviv from continuing their attempt at genocide and ethnic cleansing. At the demonstration, there was widespread approval, support, and even gratitude and admiration for Tehran's counterattack against the unprecedented bombing assassination at an embassy.
I'm not an anti-Semite, and as a Muslim, I want us all to live together peacefully, but I see Iran's attack as something good on their part. Iran is the only major country which has had the courage to attack Israel and defend Palestine's innocent civilians. This war can easily stop if Israel can finally realize that they are attempting a genocide.
Those who are occupiers do not have the right to legitimate defense, but Iran does have the right, and they used it to defend Gaza as well. Israel bombs and assassinates people constantly. How can people forget about what Israel has done?
Protesters contrasted Iran's actions with those of the French foreign minister last week. After mentioning the possibility of placing sanctions on Israel over Gaza, he immediately backtracked the next day in front of Parliament.
The French government is quite the accomplice in the genocide that Israel is waging right now. Why aren't there any sanctions despite all these deaths? And when France talks so much about defending human rights, it's simply shameful.
French forces claim to have contributed to Israel's defense. In a major blow to perpetual Israeli hopes of escalating the violence, Washington has already refused to join any potential Israeli attack on Iran. It's uncertain if the cycle of Israeli assassination and Iranian retaliation is now concluded, but Israel has already returned to indiscriminate bombing and mass murder in Gaza, despite 6 months of global outrage, the murder of 34,000 Palestinians, and 76,000 injuries.
Will Israel pursue an even wider war? Will more Arab nations be inspired to join the cause of defending Gaza? What's certain is that many are happy that, for one night at least, the guns aimed at Gaza's civilians finally fell silent. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Pakistanis are showing staunch solidarity with the Iranian retaliatory strikes against the Israeli-occupied territories. Social media platforms overflow with messages of congratulations for Iran's effective response to Israel's atrocities, hailing Iran as a courageous champion of Muslim states willing to confront a Zionist regime, especially following months of atrocities against the Gaza Strip.
We are proud of Iran for taking a stand against Israel's aggression. The Palestinians have been suffering for decades, and it's time someone took action to protect them. Iran's attack shows that they won't tolerate the oppression any longer.
I fully support Iran's decision to strike back against Israel. The Palestinians have been living under siege for decades, and it's high time someone stood up for them. Iran's actions give hope to oppressed people everywhere.
The Pakistani government has echoed both the sentiments of its citizens and voiced grave concerns over escalation of tensions in the Middle East. Islamabad underscored the Israeli blockade of Gaza as a significant factor contributing to the recent wave of tensions, emphasizing the urgent need for international intervention to prevent further escalations in the region.
Iran has done the right thing, legally and morally, because Iran has retaliated against Israeli unwarranted aggression and attack on Iranian diplomatic installation in Damascus. And that was a violation of UN Charter and international law. So what Iran has done is the right thing. They have responded in kind, and they have taken the battle to the aggressor, and they have hit Israel.
The people of Pakistan emphasize the urgent need for global intervention to halt the escalation of conflict in the region and call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Iran's attack on Israeli-occupied territories has garnered widespread support from Pakistanis, particularly due to their perceived alignment with the plight of people in Gaza. The warm reception of Tehran's operation by the Pakistani nation highlights its desire for a more assertive response to Israel's ongoing atrocities against Palestinians. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
German police have stormed the pro-Palestine conference in the capital Berlin and arrested a number of participants. The Palestine Congress was an important event for the Palestinian solidarity movement in Europe. It was set to be held in the German capital from April 12 to 14. The participants aimed to denounce Israeli apartheid and genocide and Germans' complicity in the genocide of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
We are the Palestine Congress. We accuse the Israeli state of carrying out genocide. And we accuse the German government of supporting, of abetting, of making possible this genocide.
On Friday afternoon, several hundred activists assembled in South Berlin to attend the conference. Soon after the conference started, it was interrupted by the city's police, which had dispatched more than 900 police officers to the area. Outside the conference venue, police officers arrested a man for hoisting a Palestinian flag on a building. The participants inside the conference venue also faced repression. Even the registered journalists were refused entry by the police officers who had been deployed inside the conference hall.
I was in the list, and as I came, they told me I'm not allowed to enter because there were too many people already inside.
The first part of the conference focused on the history of Palestine.
May marks 76 years since the Palestinian Nakba. 76 years of colonization, of forced exile. However, next month also marks 76 years of resilience, 76 years of a struggle for liberation.
The German police stormed the event during a speech by the Palestinian researcher Salman Abu Sitta, who addressed the conference via video link because he had been not allowed to enter Germany. Police said he was subject to a ban on political activity in the country.
The Palestine Congress was happening. We were watching a video. The police came and shut down the electricity. They didn't give a justification about it. They didn't tell us why. Nevertheless, the police came here, shut it down, said it in the loudspeaker. People are supposed to leave the building right now. You see, they're already taking people.
Chaotic scenes followed. At least two people were arrested inside the hall and several others were interrogated. German Interior Minister Nancy Faeser hailed the police, saying it was good how the police had reacted.
An hour after the start of the conference, German police stormed the conference hall because of a speech on the history of Palestine. In an act of extreme repression, they broke up the conference, declaring it an illegal assembly. However, the Palestine Solidarity Movement vows to continue the conference. Dieter Reinisch from Berlin.
Just one day after France's foreign minister earned praise for saying that sanctions on Israel could be coming over their refusal to allow humanitarian aid to Gaza, he quickly backtracked in a session before Parliament. Many are saying the episode revealed the uniquely powerful sway Zionism has in France.
France, although it has the biggest Jewish community in Europe, has also the most extreme right-wing anti-Palestinian Jewish community in Europe. And this this Jewish community in France has a lot of saying and a lot of control over the media, over the political class. So you have very few people within this community who are protesting what's going on in the Middle East. Not like the United States and Great Britain.
The majority of France's Jews fled from former French colonies in Africa once those countries gained independence in the 1950s and 1960s, and they reportedly brought with them stringent anti-Arab and pro-imperialist views. In 2019, French Parliament controversially and incorrectly equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and they are currently reviewing a proposal to fully criminalize anti-Zionism.
They're saying straight, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Therefore, any criticism of Zionism, any criticism of Israel, means you are a criminal because you're an anti-Semite. And so it's killing all debate. Now, all throughout the collective West, but especially in France, The number one threat to freedom of speech is the Zionist movement and the pro-Israeli movement. And I weigh my words because it's very, very dangerous to say something like that in France because you'll find yourself in court.
Since October 7th, support for Hamas and even support for Palestine is often being prosecuted as so-called apology for terrorism. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations were banned nationwide for weeks, leading to thousands of fines on protesters, with protesters arrested and prosecuted for apology for terrorism for as little as carrying a Palestinian flag. Without the ability to openly criticize the policies of Israel, many believe it's difficult to imagine that Paris will reduce its unconditional support for Tel Aviv, no matter how many atrocities and war crimes they commit against Palestinians. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
South Korea's progressives extended their majority in the National Assembly in an election largely seen as a repudiation of conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol and his People Power Party. Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung promised to work for the greater good.
The ruling and opposition parties must work together to solve livelihood problems. We will spearhead the efforts to overcome the livelihood crisis. I once again express deep gratitude to the South Korean people.
Many South Koreans feel President Yoon has been overstepping his powers with a series of missteps and controversial measures, including the failure to resolve an ongoing doctor's strike.
There were too many cases where this government pushed through policies that made no sense, as if it were a dictatorship.
While the vote revolved around Yoon and the economy, with problems such as a lack of affordable housing and increasing polarization, Yoon's foreign policy latitude will also be curtailed.
This is really bad news for President Yoon. He's going to have an extremely hard time getting anything through the National Assembly. And what's more, it may jeopardize some of his great relations that he's formed with the U.S. and Japan during his presidency.
A new progressive party launched by Cho Guk, a former justice minister, won 12 seats in the assembly, further tipping the scales against President Yoon and his People Power Party.
The two-thirds majority enjoyed by progressives in the assembly will enable them to fast-track legislation and push their liberal agenda. Meanwhile, President Yoon's pro-business reforms stand little chance of becoming law, with Yoon something of a lame duck for the final 3 years of his five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has released a new statement following Sunday's drone attack on Russian-held Zaporizhzhia power plant in eastern Ukraine. Tajani said the risk of creating a new Chernobyl must be averted and that a free zone around the nuclear plant must be immediately declared. He also advised against fighting in the vicinity of the nuclear plant. A few days ago, during a celebration for the 75th NATO anniversary, Tajani hinted at the possibility of resuming ties with Russia in the future.
We are not at war with Russia. We criticize Moscow's policies, but we are not at war with the Russian people, and we definitely intend to resume relations with the Russian people.
It is the first time Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, has been targeted in military action since November 2022. On Tuesday, Russia blamed Ukraine for launching drone attacks on the plant for a third day, but Ukraine denied an involvement.
The Italian Foreign Ministry's position on the nuclear plant attack is very interesting. Rome, for the first time since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, is not just taking the side of Kiev, but it is pragmatically looking at the interests of the whole of Europe, without focusing on who is to blame for the attack.
Also on Tuesday, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell reiterated a warning that the UN's atomic watchdog IAEA issued earlier this week. Borrell said the reckless drone attack in Zaporizhzhia increases the risk of a dangerous nuclear accident. Italy has often reaffirmed its unwavering support for Ukraine, despite Russia's warning against such moves. The Italian government has so far approved 6 military support packages to Kyiv, inclusive of both lethal and non-lethal equipment, and specialized military training activities. Max Civili, Rome.
As India prepares to hold the world's largest electoral exercise from April 19, the main opposition National Congress Party has said the country will lose its secular democratic credentials if the ruling BJP attains power.